Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. They're real clients. They're banking clients. They're trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hello, everybody, and we are back with another important show to talk about what is happening in the market. Again, the number to call with questions, toll-free, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. That's the number. Anyway, I don't have any particular media appearances that I know about, but it's important if you want to catch me live on some of these television shows to watch the website on a daily basis, because generally I have no more than a 24-hour notice of television appearances, and many times I only have a 5 or 10 hour notice. They call me in the morning and they ask me if I could do it, that later that day. So right now, as far as I know, I don't have anything scheduled, but that could change. So keep checking the website. I always put my media appearances up in the upper right hand corner. You know, recently I finally broke into CNN. I was on the I'm blanking on the guy's name, but on CNN Headline News, and I've been on that show now twice. I was on last week, and they called me, and they brought me back again, and so I think I might start being on that show quite a bit more often on CNN. Hopefully, that'll segue into some other CNN shows, because really, up until now, I've only been doing the CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. And it took a while, too, before I finally got on Fox. But once I got onto one thing on Fox, then I started doing a lot more Fox appearances. So, my guess is that I'll start being on CNN quite a bit more often than I have been. And so just check the website for any appearances. I'm trying to find out what the name of that guy's show is that I did, and I have it somewhere in my file. But it's a one-hour show. I think it's an hour show. It's not on the main CNN. It's on Headline, a CNN Headline News. Meanwhile, the archives, though, I think the first appearance are up there on my website. I don't know if the one that I did, the second appearance, which I just did the other day, I don't know if that one is up. But he also has a radio show, too, which I'm going to start doing. I don't normally put a message about when I'm going to be doing a radio show up on the site, but I know he has a radio show as well. Anyway, it's also interesting too that ever since this whole crisis began to unfold, the one show that I haven't been on has been Kudlow on CNBC. It's interesting too because the last time I was on Kudlow, I actually really predicted these problems. I said the housing market's imploding, and I predicted a lot of the stuff that's happened. You'd have figured they'd have wanted me back on. But, and they've certainly had plenty of bears on between my last appearance, but it's been a couple of months. And during all this time, it's interesting that they haven't called me. I'm wondering if they feel that I'm a little bit too good an arguer of the point, that maybe they don't want the bearish position articulated quite so well. I don't know, but it's interesting. Anyway, the one main event that's happened, I think, since our last conversation last week was the Federal Reserve reducing the discount rate by 50 basis points, which is most likely a prelude to a cut in the Fed funds rate, but we'll see. Again, I still think that that Bernanke is a little hesitant to actually cut the Fed funds rate for fear of what that might do to the dollar. So I don't know. Maybe this, I called it a trial balloon on a couple of the TV appearances that I did So we'll have to see. But the market is certainly reacting as if the Fed funds rate is going to be cut. But I think regardless of what they do, right, I think that, you know, the U.S. economy is still headed for recession. I don't think there's any way the Fed can stop that, although in the short run, certainly some of the market participants, you know, might not understand that. Glenn Beck, I just remember, that's the guy whose show I did on CNN, the Glenn Beck show on CNN Headline News. So, you know, the public or the investing community might initially be excited by some kind of rate cut by the Fed, thinking that that will avert a recession. But there's no way. I mean, a recession is an absolute certainty. It's a foregone conclusion. There's no way we cannot have a recession. I don't care what the Fed does with interest rates, because they're not going to reflate this housing bubble. No matter how low they bring rates down, they're not going to recreate the subprime market. They're not going to bring back all these lax lending standards. So without that, real estate prices cannot return to where they were. They have to go back down to levels that existed before this housing bubble, which means all the home equity is going to go away. And no matter how many rate cuts they have, it's not going to put it back. And even when these mortgages reset, even if they don't reset to levels as high as they otherwise would, absent rate cuts, they're still going to reset to levels substantially above where they are now. And that's going to be the problem. And so the evaporation of home equity, the higher monthly payments associated with, you know, increased ARM payments, plus, remember, the cost of food, the cost of energy, other consumer prices are likely to continue their ascent, you know, making it more and more difficult for Americans to spend. And, you know, it's interesting that everybody is trying to wonder, you know, whether or not what's happened will reduce consumer spending, and people are hopeful or optimistic that it won't. But the point that everybody is missing here is that the reason that we have this crisis, and it's going to get a lot worse, is because of consumer spending. Consumers spent too much, and they paid for all that spending by borrowing money. They borrowed a lot of money to buy houses. They borrowed a lot of money against their houses to buy other things like cars and furniture and big screen TVs. And that's why we're in this mess, because consumers spent too much. Now, to hope that they're going to keep spending, you know, is more of the problem, right? Again, as I've said, there's no way to do that without a recession. And nobody wants a recession, so all they want us to do is keep on exacerbating the problem. They're hoping that Americans will ignore, right, their loss of home equity, will ignore the increased cost of servicing their mortgage, and go out and spend money anyway. That they'll find a Visa or a MasterCard that isn't maxed out and go out and spend it. I mean, it's ridiculous that everybody wants more reckless behavior. Now, I think one of the most dangerous things that I've heard is regarding potential proposals to alter the bankruptcy laws to allow bankruptcy judges to reduce the value of mortgages of people who go through bankruptcy. Right now, you know, you don't do that. At least the creditor would get your house and be able to sell it for whatever it's worth. But I think some of these proposals would have to do with the bankruptcy judge being able to take a mortgage balance that maybe is $500,000 and simply reducing it to $200,000 or some level that the borrower can afford, which I think would be another disaster for mortgage lending, because it would make mortgage lending inherently much riskier than it already is, and it would, you know, force more people out of the mortgage market. Now, we've had, since last week, a number of high-profile mortgage companies have gone out of business, have been shut down. That Greenlight that was purchased by one of the major firms, you know, just a couple of years ago for a couple of $1 billion, just shut down. Also, I know they announced today that Countrywide, which must have been on the verge of bankruptcy, just announced a $2 billion investment from Bank of America that bought a bunch of preferred stock with a high coupon below the market. So I think they needed that capital desperately. But I guess the market will react positively to that $2 billion infusion by Bank of America. But, you know, the mortgage market is changing. It's going to go back to people lending out their own money, which means, you know, we're going to go back to much more stringent lending standards, because the banks now, who are going to be moving back into the mortgage market, are going to be issuing mortgages and holding them on their books. They're going to be lending out their depositors' money, and so they're going to be far more careful about who they lend to and under what terms and what kind of collateral. You know, it's interesting that, you know, when I did, I don't know if anybody is listening to this program. You know, we don't have any calls in. I mean, that's kind of weird. I'm surprised that, you know, yes, last time we had to turn callers away. The number to call is 888-678-9597. 888-678-9597. I don't know if anybody is listening who attended any of the mortgage brokers conferences that I spoke at in Las Vegas and in, I think the other one was either in San Francisco or Oregon or Washington State. I can't remember. But I know I spoke at least three or four of these mortgage brokers conferences. And, you know, the big exhibitors at these conferences were all these mortgage brokers, all these lenders, these subprime guys. And I remember when I made my speeches, the crux of my presentation was that all the exhibitors were going to be out of business. Within a couple of years they'd all be gone. And I said that a lot of the people in the mortgage industry are going to have to be looking for new jobs. And I was trying to give them some encouragement, some career counseling as to what they can do, to supplement or as far as a new career. And I even, you know, suggested one of the reasons I wanted them to invest with me was so they can have some positions that would hedge them from a decline in the housing market. So I wonder, I don't know if anybody who happened to be in attendance at any of those conferences is here. But the layoffs, I mean, are dramatic. I forget, over 100 of these firms have gone out of business. Tens of thousands of mortgage brokers have been laid off. Just, I think the news came out today that Lehman Brothers is shutting its mortgage division, laying off tons of people. I think Bear Stearns already shut theirs. I mean, obviously all the brokerage firms, because a lot of these brokerage firms went out and bought. They invested in the mortgage brokers because they wanted to own the whole channel, because they were originating all these subprime mortgages, and then they were bundling them up and reselling them, and they started, you know, they vertically integrated. But now, you know, they're all taking huge write-downs and getting out of this business. So it's going to go back to, you know, traditional lending. And again, when you go back to traditional lending, you go back to traditional pricing. And we have had nothing like traditional pricing in the real estate market for the past 6 or 7 years. I mean, prices have been way out of whack. I don't know if anybody ever saw the charts that show real estate prices adjusted for inflation going back about 100 years, and real estate prices just tracked the CPI until about 7 or 8 years ago, and then there was a huge divergence. Now, part of that, I believe, is because the CPI is now understating inflation. So part of that is because inflation is actually higher than the CPI. But a larger part about it is because real estate prices just completely decoupled from rationality. And the reason that happened was because of all these lax lending standards. And, of course, everybody that lent money based on those standards is now losing a ton of money, and that's not going to happen anymore. So that, if you've seen that graph, real estate prices are now going to have to plunge back down to where they would normally be. Now, again, it's my point that they can't stop at normal because of the huge overbuilding, the glut of properties on the market, and the number of properties that are owned by speculators and homeowners that can't really afford them. I think before real estate prices can get to a normal level, they're going to have to get very cheap. You know, pendulums tend to swing in opposite directions by equal magnitude. So I think as overvalued as real estate is today or was, I think that's how cheap it's going to get before ultimately moving to a normal level maybe 5 or 10 years from now. I have no idea how long it'll take before real estate prices can return to normal after plunging. But they still have a long way to go down. And there's no way, there's no way that real estate prices can go back to normal without a massive recession, because basically what you're talking about is a situation where the average American just basically is completely wiped out. I mean, all their home equity is gone, and that's their main asset. And it's not just, you know, again, it's not just mortgage credit that's drying up. It's not just home loans that have been, you know, sliced and diced by Wall Street and sold to investors. It's car loans. It's credit card debt. All sorts of consumer debt. They've created all sorts of asset-backed loans, and there's going to be losses in these as well. And so the people that have been lending us money and buying all the securitized debt, they're not going to be doing it anymore. So it's, I mean, it's amazing that I see so many people coming on some of these financial shows and acting like, you know, everything is fine. Like this is just a blip on the radar, that the fundamentals for the economy are sound. You know, I saw an interview with Paulson the other day, you know, on CNBC, and he was saying the same thing. He said it's a good thing this crisis is happening when the economy is in such great shape so we can handle it. I mean, these guys are clueless. I mean, of course, you know, they could just be lying, and that's more likely the case. But, you know, the whole idea that the economy can be strong is nonsense. I wish I could have interviewed Paulson because he's talking about how great the fundamentals are. I wish I could say, what fundamentals are you talking about? What are the great fundamentals? I mean, of course, they'll point to the strength of the global economy. I'll say, fine, but what's the strength of the American economy? Where's the good fundamentals here? You know, because all of our whole economy was based on consumer spending, based on consumers being able to leverage their homes and borrow money cheaply and buy things, and all that's coming to an end. And so an economy that's based on that, you know, you live by consumer credit and mortgage credit, and you die by it as well, and that's what's going to happen. But you've got all these guys denying it, and so many people, you know, and it's all these people, too, that were completely blindsided. I mean, there's so many people that go on these financial shows or that write, and, you know, that this thing came out of left field. I mean, they were completely clueless, despite the fact that the evidence was overwhelming that this was going to happen. They were completely clueless. And now those same people are just as convinced that this is not a big deal, that we'll shrug it off, that the economy is sound, that the U.S., everything is good. Anyway, we've got a couple of callers. Let me take a call from Steve in Rochester, New York. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Well, how are you?
Good, thanks. I have a question, something about this sell-off that I find rather perplexing. I mean, people are calling it a credit crunch and a crisis, and those words are being thrown around, yet I'm seeing high beta names like RIM and Google and Amazon with ridiculous price-earnings ratios and market capitalizations holding up and thriving. And if people really had to sell things to get liquid, why aren't they selling those?
Well, you know, for some reason, the technology sector is acting more as a safe haven, you know, beneficiary of money that's leaving stocks that are more tied to the consumer in the United States, tied to credit, banking, brokerage. People are looking at that, at least in the U.S., as a way to play the strength of the global economy. Some of the more high-profile tech names had some pretty good earnings as a result of exports. So for some reason, whoever's, you know, the people who have had to raise cash and who've had some of these tech stocks, it's been offset by money flowing into these stocks. And so I think that that's a foolish place to go. But nevertheless, money is moving into those as a safe haven. Ultimately, I think that, you know, these stocks are too expensive to be you know good value plays.
Oh yeah, you see anything with a big short interest like Crocs or Amazon, they just really won't go down. It's amazing.
A lot of the hedge funds that have positions that have to be covered, if the positions they're covering are short positions, they have to buy.
Okay.
And so if you're a hedge fund and you're long, let's say you're short Google and long, you know, some oil stock. Right. When you get a margin call, you've got to sell oil stocks and buy Google. So sometimes margin calls can force you to buy if you're covering a short position. So, yeah, I mean, some of the stocks that have big short positions have rallied because that's what the action that the people who own them had to take.
And what do you think? Do you think the carry trade is in a process of unwinding?
Well, I don't think it's. I think a lot of people in the carry trade. And there's all sorts of carry trades, right? All a carry trade is selling something, borrowing it at one rate and reinvesting at a higher rate. You know, and there's all sorts of carry trades going on all over the place. I don't think that is going to stop. I think there's been a big flush out in a lot of these trades. But I do think, especially when people talk about shorting the yen and buying other currencies, I still think that trade is going to be profitable. I still think if you look at the yields in Australia or in New Zealand or in you know Europe compared to Japan, it's still a huge advantage. And I think once this is flushed out, and of course the yen is a lot higher, and these other currencies are a lot lower, people are going to put those trades back on. I just don't think the Japanese are going to raise interest rates in the short run sufficiently to deter people from re-entering those trades.
Yeah, it seems to me that the yen, whenever it appreciates, our market sells off and commodities sell off, and then when it goes back down, our markets start rallying again.
That's really the function of everything going in the same direction, you know, when people are because a lot of people are borrowing yen to finance those investments. And but eventually there's going to be a big decoupling. I mean, there's no question in my mind. In fact, you know, the fact that some of these foreign stocks have sold off so rapidly and so many people are still convinced that, oh, you see, look, if our market goes down, the foreign markets are dead, you know, we're the leader, you know, this is going to get the global economy is going to shrug this off. Because the global economy, I still think, is sound. I think it is imbalanced, and there are some problems. But I think the main problems in the global economy have to do with the subsidy of the American economy. And I really believe that when the U.S. market drops sharply, when we're in a recession, and when the world is no longer lending us so much money and shipping us so much of their production, that the rest of the world is going to boom. You know, there might be a little bit of a stumble, but in my book, in Crash Proof, I use the analogy of the U.S. economy and World War II, and how at the end of the Second World War, I know we didn't go into a depression because 10 million soldiers were unemployed or because, you know, factories were no longer producing bombs. You know, what happened was those soldiers just did something more productive than fight wars, and those factories produced something other than bombs. You know, they produce for domestic consumption. So, you know, when Chinese factories are freed up, when they no longer have to make stuff for us, when instead they can make stuff for themselves, you know, and when Chinese savings no longer have to be loaned to Americans, but they're available to be loaned to Chinese entrepreneurs who can make much better use of that money than some American remodeling his kitchen. You know, this is going to be a huge boom, and that's what so few people understand. So, I mean, the dip that we've had recently in foreign currencies, particularly in, you know, in the ones that were the recipient of the carry trade, and a lot of these foreign assets, I mean, people should be buying this stuff as fast as they can, because these prices, I don't think they're going to stay low for long. And eventually, the U.S. market's going to go down, and no one's going to care. You know, just like the Japanese market went down for the 1990s, and it didn't seem to stop most of the other markets in the world from rising. It's not like the United States market has to go up for foreign markets to go up.
So you would differ from Mark Faber, who thinks the emerging markets are in for a major sell-off.
I think some of them are, and that's why I've avoided most of the emerging markets. I'm in the developed markets. I think there has been a lot of speculation in those markets, and some of the PEs are out of hand, and I think that when the U.S. market really tanks, there could be some big sell-offs in some of those markets, but then you want to jump in and buy, because the best thing for the emerging markets is the submerging United States, because, you know, they're the ones that are going to really benefit. A lot of these emerging market currencies are really going to take off once they let the dollar collapse. And a lot of the problems in these emerging markets have to do with monetary policies that are aimed at keeping the dollar from collapsing.
Okay. Well, that's great. Thanks for all your answers. Last quick question. Natural gas, it's been taking it on a chin lately. Do you have any take on it?
Yeah, well, you know, the hurricane didn't do any real damage. I don't know. I think there are some speculators in there. I think it's just another event, another market-related, you know, people just being forced out of positions. But eventually I'm looking for natural gas prices to turn around. I mean, I don't know exactly when, but I think they will.
Thanks for your time, Peter.
Fine. Okay. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Hey, let's take a quick break for the commercial, and we'll pick up with some more calls in about a minute.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
I'm back, and I'm watching the markets trading overseas, and the S&P futures are up about 12 points, pretty big move, and all the foreign stocks are up big. You know, we've had pretty, yesterday was a huge rally in today, so a lot of these stocks that we own that were so far down, I mean, a lot of these stocks have completely recovered their losses. I mean, it's, you know, some of these stocks are so far off their lows. So there's some of the clients who were, you know, had their wits about them and who were able to buy last week. I mean, some of the prices that we picked up were really, really incredible prices. Now, of course, the currencies haven't completely recovered. So some of the, like the Australian and New Zealand dollars are still way below where they were. But I think that can change very quickly, too. I mean, these currencies, you know, can turn around almost as quickly as they collapse. But a lot of the stocks have already recouped everything that they've lost in a decline, which is, you know, and again, I think some of the declines that we saw were just absolutely ridiculous in stocks, you know, utilities and things that were relatively safe, but when you just get a flood of orders. And that's why I know some people, when you know, some of my clients who called up who were nervous, who saw this happening, you know, I understand the psychological aspect of getting nervous because you're seeing the price of your stock fall. But the reality is it means nothing. I mean, the stocks are owned. Right? People own assets, right? And sometimes people are in trouble. When they're in trouble and they have to sell something, they don't necessarily get a good price for it, you know? But just because somebody else is in trouble and has to sell a valuable asset for a cheap price, it doesn't impact value of your asset. I mean, it impacts it that day if you have to sell it as well. But it's like if, you know, if somebody sells a dollar bill for 50 cents, you know, it doesn't mean that you run out and sell your dollar bills for 50 cents because that person did it. You don't know what their circumstances were. Now, I use the analogy of a house. I mean, sometimes, and of course right now it's not a great analogy because houses are so overpriced. But in normal circumstances, you know, sometimes people have to sell an asset, a house, in a hurry for some reason. Maybe they're leaving the country, they get a job transfer, there's a divorce, and sometimes the sale is not necessarily an arm's-length transaction. Sometimes there's extenuating circumstances where a house needs to be sold quickly. And when that happens, oftentimes a house might sell for 10, 20, 30% or more below, you know, what it would normally sell for under normal circumstances. You know, that doesn't mean that everybody in the neighborhood has to rush out and panic and say, oh my God, I got to sell my house now. You know, but for some reason, when it happens with the stock market, a lot of people get nervous when they see stocks that they own selling for a low price. I mean, all you really have to understand is that, you know, well, who cares about that low price? Because I'm certainly not going to sell my shares at that low price. So whatever the circumstances were today that caused some sellers to have to accept such a lousy price for their shares, it doesn't affect you. Because we're not going to sell into a panic environment. We're going to sell. Now, sometimes people create this and bring it on themselves. Sometimes people do panic. They see somebody else sell the stock for a cheap price, and they think, oh, my God, what does that person know? Maybe the stock's going to keep on falling. I better sell, too. Well, the reality is the person doesn't know anything. The person that's the sales that came in that caused the stock to drop, let's say, 30% in a few days, the people who are selling don't know any more than we do. They don't have any inside information. They're just selling because they have to. They don't have a choice. You know, they get a margin call, or they get a redemption. They got to sell. You know, they got to sell. That's all they can do, and they got to take whatever price is there. So don't think that there's something that you don't know. There's some insider information that, gee, the stock is down 30%. I better sell it before it goes down 40%. No. When people do that, they're making a problem where there wasn't one. Just because the stock goes down, it doesn't affect us at all. If we don't sell it, who cares? Don't even look at it. You know, there's nothing wrong with the companies. There's nothing wrong with their earning streams. All that happened is somebody else was over-leveraged, and now they got to sell their stock for a low price. The only thing you do in times like that is take advantage of it. If you happen to have money, right, and you can take advantage of somebody who's in a desperate situation and who is selling at a price that, you know, that's really low, then that's a great time if you have a spare money lying around to put it to work, because you can really take advantage of somebody else's short-term problem. And that's what happens. Now, some people can say, well, gee, I wish I didn't buy. Let's say somebody bought, you know, a couple of weeks before the decline, and that's the only money they had. Okay, yeah, you could be upset that you didn't wait. Gee, I guess I could have waited and I could have bought it cheaper. But, you know, we don't know. I mean, it might have gone up. And it's like, you know, sometimes, you know, you go into the department store and there's a shirt on sale, and you buy it, you think it's a good price, and then you go back a week later, and now they marked it down another 20%. And you're like, God, you know, darn it, I should have waited. Well, how do you know? Maybe somebody would have bought that shirt, and then it wouldn't have been there at the next markdown. But if you got a good price on it, all right, it doesn't matter if somebody else got a better price. You still bought it at a good price. And if you go down there and, you know, you see the shirt, you know, the shirt is on sale for another 20%. That doesn't mean you go and try to sell your shirt because you think, oh my, you know, it's lost value. You just got to put it in perspective and not worry and not let, you know, your emotions rule your decision making. Now, in some cases, right, people, you know, the U.S. stock market is going down, and you know, I think a lot of U.S. stocks are going to keep going down. I mean, certainly, let's say you're in a financial company, a mortgage lender or a broker, and the stock is down. Well, there's a good reason for it to be down, and it's probably going to go a lot lower because there's some fundamental reason behind the decline. It's not simply a liquidity issue. I mean, their businesses are going away. Their earnings are going to suffer. They might not have any earnings at all. They might have losses. So sometimes when stocks are going down, they're going down for a reason. And the smart thing to do is sell them if you were dumb enough to buy them in the first place. But you have to be able to differentiate between stocks that are going down for reasons inherent to the company and stocks that are going down for reasons that have to do with their shareholders and their shareholders' liquidity. Yes, there obviously are shareholders of some companies that are in trouble, and because of those circumstances, they need to sell. You need to differentiate that between problems with the business itself. If the business itself is sound, if the markets in which they're operating are sound, there's no reason to worry just because on paper, on your statement, it says that the stock is down 10 or 20%. Who cares? It doesn't really matter. Anyway, let me get back to the phones. I've got Glenn in California. Go ahead, Glenn. Is Glenn there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can.
The name you were looking for before was Glenn Beck.
Yeah, I remembered it. Yeah,
it was an awesome appearance. And by the way, congratulations on all the appearances you've been making. They've been. I try to watch them all live whenever possible, and it's really great seeing you on there. You're brilliant. I mean, I agree with you 100%. My big concern right now is, I think you remember I called you before a couple weeks ago, and I'm not so sure about this whole decoupling thing, and I'll tell you why, and then I'll listen to your response. For one thing, take a look at the price of gold. I don't know whether it's a function of it's being manipulated or what, but after him opening that discount window and flooding all the markets with cash, you would think that people would be smart enough and push up the gold price. But in fact, the gold price has been going down, or at least staying flat. And gold shares, I own a lot of Canadian juniors, have gotten creamed. It was a stock market crash. If you own a portfolio of gold mining shares, certainly the more you know, speculative ones, it was a disaster. I mean, I'm down 50% in a lot of those names. And I don't see how the stock market can, you know, in the United States, can crash without some of these other shares, resource shares, etc.
Let me answer what you're talking about. I mean, sure.
Yeah, no, let me respond when you're done.
It happened this time, but it's not going to happen every time. One of the reasons that some of these gold stocks, particularly the Canadians, got crushed, the juniors, is there's really a small universe of people who are buying them. I mean, it's not like everybody owns them. There's not a lot of liquidity there when you have a lot of sellers. So some of the people who own these mining shares and who have them on leverage, you know, they get margin calls. They're forced to sell. I mean, this is a liquidity event. I actually think the price of gold, okay, which is very, you know, held up very well. I mean, the price of gold didn't fall at all. Right? Gold is still above $650. So gold prices didn't go down. There are plenty of buyers for gold. Gold stocks are a different story, right? I mean, the demand for gold stocks is very different than the demand for bullion. And I think there's a lot more speculation in mining shares and a lot less liquidity. And some of the less liquid names got killed. But I'll tell you, some of the more liquid names, Barrick Gold made a new 52-week high last week. And it made a 52-week high. Then it sold off, but now it's almost back up there. So some of the bigger names that maybe bigger money is going into held up pretty well. Some of the thinner names that more speculative players would be involved in got hammered, and it's all a function of liquidity. But I still think we're setting up the ultimate move in gold stocks is going to be way up, and gold stocks are going to go up the most when the U.S. stock market goes down. And
why wouldn't Uncle Ben continue to manipulate the price of gold at the same time that he's releasing more capital into the markets, even if he does do the Fed the rate cut, which may or may not happen? At the same time, they could just sell more bullion into the market and keep gold down.
You're overestimating the ability of the Federal Reserve to manipulate the price of gold. They really can't do it. The Fed could manipulate the price of gold. It wouldn't have tripled. You know, it would still be below 300. They can't keep it down. You know, they can try, you know, and the Fed doesn't even have that much gold to sell to the market. So I don't think it's a function of manipulation.
No. We don't, as a U.S. citizen, we do not know. You know, to a certain extent, our dollar is backed by gold, but we don't have the right in this democracy of ours to find out exactly how much gold the U.S. government has and exactly how much they're selling, because they don't release the information.
I don't want to take up too much time with a one call, but I don't think that the price of gold is being heavily manipulated at all. I don't think there's a grand conspiracy. I think the price is going to go up. The fact that it hasn't gone up is not because of a conspiracy to keep it down. It's just because that the big money out there still doesn't understand the problem. They still don't understand, you know, what's going on.
And one more thing about the decoupling before you let me go. I see you on a lot of these shows, and you're the bear, and everyone, you know, points to you as the guy who says the stock market is going down. But in reality, I don't see how a company like Boeing and many of these Dow industrial stocks, you know, not a financial stock, but companies like 3M that do a lot of their business overseas, I don't see how the Dow will go down and at the same time the global story can go up. I personally, I would love to hear you elaborate on that more, because, I think if what you say will happen, if there is going to be a crash in the U.S. stock market, then that's going to be negative for all of your holdings, especially, you know, all of your holdings, international holdings, is going to be bad, because the Dow really represents the globe as much as it does the United States.
All right, let me answer the question, and then thank you for the call.
Sure.
Basically, yeah, I don't go on television saying the U.S. stock market is going to crash. I say the economy is going to collapse. What happens to the U.S. stock market, it depends on how much inflation we actually have. But a stock like Boeing is trading at 20 times earnings. So, I mean, Boeing can go down by 50% and still be at 10 times earnings. I mean, 10 times earnings is not a ridiculously cheap price for a stock. 20 times earnings is still pretty rich. I also think, and when U.S. interest rates go up, and they're going to go way up, high interest rates diminish the value of stocks because they diminish the value of earnings. But, yeah, I mean, the companies, the U.S. companies that do the most business abroad will go down the least. The stocks in the U.S. that will go down the most are the ones that are the most dependent on domestic sales, on financial services, on retailing. And I ultimately believe, unless the U.S. government blocks it, that most of the Dow Jones that is global, right, the bigger companies, will end up being acquired by Europeans, by Asians, by the Middle East, as the U.S. market collapses, particularly in terms of foreign currencies, which it certainly will. Whether the Dow collapses in terms of the dollar is a tough call, because we have no idea how much value the dollar will lose. But I do know that the U.S. market will collapse in terms of the euro and in terms of, you know, other currencies around the world, which will make U.S. assets very, very cheap for other people. And so a large number of these stocks will end up being owned by foreigners. But it's going to be very simple, I think, for the global economy to rally, because remember my thesis, and I mentioned it earlier, is that the U.S. is a drag on the global economy. It's very expensive to subsidize 300 million unproductive people. We are a giant weight on the global economy. And when they, you know, decouple this, right? When they no longer subsidize us, that is a huge boom. It's just like the boom that we had at the end of World War II. When we didn't have to waste all of our resources fighting World War II, that freed up a lot of resources for peacetime prosperity. And, you know, Americans were far better off in the 1950s than they were in the 1940s.
Well, listen, one more thing. The U.S. multinationals stand a lot to gain from a declining dollar because they'll be paying wages out in U.S. dollars, whereas, say, a European multinational will be stuck paying the high expense of a euro-based payroll.
Yeah, well, all right, I gotta let you go because I can't continue this conversation. I have other people on hold. But thanks for the call.
You got it.
But I'll very briefly mention what you just mentioned, and then I got to go on.
Okay.
No, that's not the case. What you just said was wrong, and now I don't even remember what it was. But anyway, let me skip over to Gary from Las Vegas.
Hey, Peter, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks.
I remember a couple weeks ago you said that Ben Bernanke was having to run this bluff because he was stuck between a rock and a hard place, couldn't really raise rates, couldn't really cut them. One of the things that you had said was that if he did cut rates, that you thought that would be the worst of his moves because that would lead to a collapse in the value of the dollar. And I was just wondering, in layman's terms, if you could outline the dominoes, if he does pursue a rate-cutting strategy, how do the dominoes fall that lead to a more rapid decrease in the value of the dollar?
Yeah, and I still think that it's not a slam dunk that he's going to cut the Fed funds rate. I mean, I think that, You know, if he does, I think that's a big negative. But I think what will happen is ultimately, as we embark on an easing campaign, you know, remember the last time we embarked on an easing campaign, the dollar index was at 120. Now it's at 81.5 or less. And so if they start cutting interest rates with the dollar index at long-term support, if the dollar breaks through that support, then, you know, there's nothing beneath it but air. And I think the dollar index could lose another 40 points or be cut in half, and that would move it down to 40. And that would basically mean that the currencies in the dollar index would double in value. Now, there's no way that foreigners are going to sit back and absorb those losses. They're not going to want to own U.S. dollar-denominated investments because there's no way the yields can offset them for the decline in the currency. So, you know, if foreigners won't lend us money and if foreign central banks ultimately pull out, then interest rates go sky high and consumer prices go through the roof. And, that's going to come back and unravel everything Bernanke is trying to accomplish, because if he's trying to bring down interest rates but ends up causing them to go higher, you know, what has he accomplished?
Right. Yeah.
And he doesn't want, you know, he doesn't want the dollar to go into free fall. But he can't admit that. He can't admit his real concerns. I said, the reason that the Fed has been lying and has been saying that the economy is sound is because that's all they can do. If they admit the economy is headed for recession, then the obvious point is, okay, why aren't you lowering interest rates? So they don't want to say, well, we're not lowering interest rates because the dollar would collapse. So therefore, they say the economy is in good shape. And that's why we're not lowering interest rates. We're waiting for evidence that the economy has turned down. And, you know, you don't need to. I said, you know, if someone jumps off the top of the Empire State Building, I don't have to wait till he hits the ground and know that he's going to do it. And it's obvious. So, I mean, the fact is, yeah, sure, we're going into recession. But he has to pretend otherwise.
Right. One other question, if I can take you in a completely different direction. I hear you refer to China a lot and the strength of the global economy when and if decoupling happens. The only thing that doesn't sit well with me on that is, from my understanding, and I am a neophyte, but China still appears to be a hardline communist, at least those in power. And, of course, Australia and some of these other countries are fairly socialist in their policies and their taxation levels. So, you know, how does that sit with you as far as your confidence that a lot of this isn't happening just at the point of a gun for the citizens of these countries and that can't continue indefinitely?
I'm not sure I'm following what you're asking.
Well, I'm just saying that China being the government being a stated communist government, it creates a lack of confidence in me that economy can ever strengthen, decouple from us and be a productive economy and generate wealth for itself with the Communist Party in control.
In many cases, a democracy is worse than a dictatorship. It all depends on how it's organized. I mean, a democracy is a dictatorship of the majority. I mean, America succeeded as a nation because we were not a democracy, because we were able to keep the evil forces of democracy in check. Right? What's important in prosperity is capitalism. What's important is limited government in terms of taxation and regulation, and you need to have respect for private property, and so people have to be able to voluntarily transact with each other and be secure and confident that what they earn they're going to get to keep. Now, a lot of times democracy is inconsistent with that because, you know,
right,
the majority just votes to steal the wealth and the productivity of the minority. And
those very conditions you just named, I'm with you, that was very eloquently put. Do you believe that exists in China?
Well, I don't know what. I know that the Chinese are very productive. And I know that people who are not free aren't productive. I mean, when the Soviet Union was there, and they were a big communist country, we didn't buy anything from the Soviet Union. They didn't make anything over there. And we had to subsidize them. We had to give them grain credits. They couldn't even feed themselves. They really were communists. The fact that the Chinese are selling us so many things, the fact that we have to borrow money from China, right? We're not lending them money. We're borrowing from them. The people in China, there's no way they could be as prosperous as they are if they weren't free. And when I was over there in Shanghai, you know, a month ago, I see more policemen, you know, here in America than I saw in Shanghai. I mean, I only saw a few of them. I mean, and there was I didn't see any crime or graffiti. People were, you know, the streets were crowded. People were well-dressed. People were going about their business. I didn't think that there was a big brother looking over my shoulder. My opinion is that the Chinese are freer than we are. I don't care, you know, what they want to say. I think that the average person in China, even though there's certainly corruption in the Chinese government, no question about that, but I think overall the Chinese enjoy more economic freedom than Americans, and you know, and it doesn't matter who who's the democracy and who's communist. That's the reality.
Right.
And you know, and as far as Australia and New Zealand, sure, there's a lot of socialism there. There's a lot of socialism here.
Sure. Right.
In cases, I think there's less of it over there than there is over here.
Wow. Well, that's a great answer. I appreciate your insight and everything, and keep up the good work. Thanks.
Thanks. And, you know, the real bottom line is, you know, look at, you know, nobody is subsidizing these other currencies. You know, there is an intervention. You know, foreign central banks aren't buying up these other currencies to artificially prop them up. It's the U.S. economy that's in the most trouble. And again, the cost of subsidizing us. I mean, think about it. I mean, imagine if you're working for a living, and all of a sudden, you know, your mother-in-law, your in-laws, your brother-in-law moves in with his wife and kids, and they don't have a job, and all of a sudden they're living with you, and now you got to feed them. Let's say they're overweight and they eat a lot, and you know, and you got to completely support them. You know, and they want their own TV, they want a stereo, they want, you know, I mean, all of a sudden you're having to support an entire other family. I mean, that's expensive. You know, I mean, the minute they leave, you're going to celebrate, right? It's like, oh my God, now I don't have to work so hard anymore. Maybe I can enjoy some of my money myself for a change. I don't have these freeloaders, mooching off me. Well, think of Americans. We're 300 million mooching freeloaders living off the productivity of the rest of the world. Now, when I say stuff like this, you know, I was on Fox TV the other day, and the big guy, Charles Payne, seems like a big teddy bear of a guy. He seems like a nice guy, but, you know, he's really, you know, he basically says, look, I'm anti-American, or every time he hears me talk, I'm anti-American. Look, it doesn't mean I'm anti-American because I'm pointing out the fact that we're a burden on the world, right? I don't like the fact that we're a burden, but that's the truth. Right? The truth is our economy is screwed up. The truth is America isn't doing anybody any favors by consuming. You know, we're not doing the world a favor by riding in their wagon. And I'm just pointing it out. It doesn't mean I'm un-American because I recognize the fact that America is not a positive factor in the global economy. Now, that wasn't always the case. I mean, we have a history. I mean, America was at one point, the best thing that the world economy had going, certainly. But unfortunately, that's not the situation today. And it doesn't mean that one day in the future, America can't be, back and can't be a force for good and a positive force in the global economy again. I hope we can be. But the fact that I recognize that what we're doing now is hurting the rest of the world doesn't mean I'm un-American. I'm certainly anti what we're doing. I'm anti our phony economy, and I think that, you know, that we need to go back to our roots. We can't continue this way. But it doesn't mean it's un-American. But, I mean, it's interesting. If you didn't see that show, it was the most recent Fox, Cavuto on Business, that I was on this Saturday. When, you know, and that's what a lot of times, too, I've mentioned that some of my biggest critics happen to come from the right and not from the left. You know, the Republicans, you know, the minute they hear me saying something negative about the market and the economy, they immediately think I'm a communist or something. Anyway, I don't know if we took the second break. If we haven't, let's go ahead and do that. Did we?
Euro-Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro-Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro-Pacific Capital.
Okay, I am back, and let me go right to the phones. I've got Ed patiently waiting from California. Go ahead, Ed.
Hi, Peter. Enjoyed the appearances on Glenn Beck. That's a different audience.
I'm interested to see, you know, I think the CNN audience is a little bit more mainstream, so if I can, you know, the show I'd love to get on is Lou Dobbs. You know, I've tried to get to Lou Dobbs, and I haven't had any success. But hopefully, maybe, you know, this avenue will lead to that show.
My question is, why do you prefer to buy the foreign stocks in their money or on their exchanges versus just buying them through an American exchange?
Well, if you buy the foreign stocks, I mean, are you talking about an ADR or the same stocks but over the counter?
Either over-the-counter or some of them, even the energy things, they trade on NYSE.
I mean, for an energy trust, it doesn't matter. Right? If the stock is listed on the New York Stock Exchange, it doesn't matter if you buy it in New York or Toronto. You're going to get a fair price. So that's fine. And we buy some of the energy trusts in the U.S. if they trade there.
Okay.
But the reason that I prefer to buy stocks locally that don't have ADRs is because there is much more volume in their home market, and therefore we can buy them at a better price. If you buy them in the U.S. over the counter through a market maker, you end up adding 5 or 10 or sometimes 20% in spreads to your trades.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, once you own the stock, it doesn't matter how you acquired it. If you bought it over the counter, you bought it in Singapore, you own the same company. You're going to get the same dividend. But the reason we don't buy in the local market is because it's a ripoff. You're able to save a lot of money by buying the stocks directly. Now, if there's an ADR, generally it's okay. But most of the stocks that we buy don't have ADRs. And if they do, they're very thin. And they don't trade a lot. And then, again, you're going to have a problem with liquidity. So I want to trade in the liquid markets where the spreads are the narrowest so that we can easily buy and sell these stocks. I don't want to be at the mercy of some market maker.
Okay, great. That answers that. And one quick question. If the Fed does not reduce the rate in September, where it seems to me it's already been sort of factored in and maybe why the American markets have been going up this week, if he doesn't do it, won't that kind of lead to a big disappointment, maybe another sell-off because they're all expecting the rate cut?
I think so. That could be, depending on what happens between now and then. I think the market is getting pretty excited by this news of Bank of America coming into Countrywide because I think people were afraid that they might have been going bankrupt, and maybe they would have. Maybe they needed that $2 billion infusion. Looking at, you know, the futures were almost up 15 points. But I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, I think if they do cut rates and the market rallies, I think it's a great opportunity to sell domestic stocks, you know, for people that own them. If they don't cut, yeah, the market might sell off if the meeting comes and they don't cut. But I think a lot of people are expecting them to cut before the meeting. But, you know, I don't know. Every time I do these shows, it's amazing that people keep saying, but you know, everything is okay. Well, you know, it's not happening. I mean, people expect everything to fall apart overnight. I mean, a lot of this takes time to work its way through the system. Now, I don't think it's going to take years. I mean, some of these things might happen in weeks or months. But the economy is going to roll over. I heard some reports today about the weakness in the auto sales and how people are delaying purchases of cars because of home equity or because of higher mortgage payments, which is obviously natural. I mean, I hear people talking all the time about thinking that somehow that falling home equity prices and rising mortgages isn't going to impact spending at all, which is it's so ridiculous to think that, because you have to think that, you know, home equity, right, people having their home double in price over the last 5 years, that didn't cause them to spend more than they otherwise would have. I mean, you have to think that, you know, that the fact that people had adjustable rate mortgages, that they didn't spend the savings, that they were somehow socking away all the money in the bank, which we know they weren't doing because the savings rate is negative. So the consumption is a complete function of home equity and low mortgage payments. And the minute mortgage payments go up, the minute home equity goes away or declines, consumers have to spend less money, period. There's no other way it can happen.
Well, Peter, it wasn't that long ago that everyone was saying the subprime was contained and real estate had hit a bottom, so we know how right they were on that. And that was only 2 or 3 months ago.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, there are people that can't, you know, they'll never see it. I mean, you know, people are going to wait until, you know, we're in a complete depression and hyperinflation before they're going to concede that there's a problem.
Peter, the resets aren't really hitting until October.
I know, and then that's just the beginning.
Yeah, that's the beginning of it. And it's going to go on for a year, so I think we're a long way from being over this.
And of course, as soon as they reset, the immediate reaction of many of the people that have these mortgages is going to be to try to pay them. I mean, and they're, you know, so it's not like just because they reset that immediately they're going to go into default. They might pay them for 3 months or 6 months and then realize they can't do it. Or when they see their house has declined, you know, initially they'll think their house is still worth a certain amount of money, so they're going to make the mortgage payments to try to protect that home equity. But the minute they make the mental acknowledgement that the home equity is gone, then the real reason for making that payment is no longer there.
Well, they'll also immediately have less discretionary money to buy things.
Of course, the minute they make the sacrifice to pay that 50% increase in their mortgage payment, the minute they do that, they have to cut back someplace else, which means somebody's going to lose their job, which means somebody's not going to have any income, or somebody who's working on commission, let's say they're a car salesman and now they're selling fewer cars, well, they're going to have less money even if they have a fixed-rate mortgage. Of course, if they have an adjustable-rate mortgage, even more problematic. So as the economy goes into recession, I mean, the writing is on the wall. It's amazing how few people can read it.
I'm always amazed by your fellow guests on this show who just seem like everything's just fine, and it's just not. But thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call. Anyway, I know we're running out of time, and, you know, I want to make another, you know, pitch for my book. I mean, hopefully everybody who's listening to this radio show has read my book, Crash Proof. But if you haven't read it, you really got to, you know, go out and get that book. You can order a copy on my website. But my real estate chapter, everything in that real estate chapter pretty much is now a history lesson. And when I wrote the book, of course, it was a forecast. But there's a lot of other important predictions made throughout that book that have yet to come true, but which all will. And also, you know, reading that book gives you a better understanding of why I have the position that I do, that the U.S. economy can suffer and global economies can prosper at the same time. That's key to understanding, you know, why I'm recommending these foreign stocks. But, you know, for no other reason than at least to get out of the U.S. dollar. Even if foreign stocks fall, I think ultimately the dollar will fall more. So we're still better off. Now, the question would be, well, are we better off in foreign cash or foreign bonds? And you can debate that. But I still think that the approach that I'm taking with conservative dividend-paying foreign stocks is the best approach, because I think that, you know, there are various scenarios under which that works. But if you haven't read the book, you know, go ahead and read it. And if you bought the book, you know, get yourself a few more copies. I mean, that book needs to get out there. I'd love to see the sales pick up. It's number like 150 right now on Amazon. but I'd really like to see that thing jump up on Amazon. You know, if you buy it there on my site, I'm trying to get the book noticed. I mean, it's not, you know, the major bookstores, yeah, they have one copy. But, I mean, people should, this book should be displayed. This book should be out front, you know, in a window or up on a tabletop. I mean, it shouldn't just be one copy, you know, buried back in the business section. I mean, the book is still the best-selling of the, you know, recent gloom and doom type books. In fact, if you get this week's issue of Smart Money Magazine, they do have a picture of the book. There's an article there about the gloom and doomers, and they mention me. Of course, they don't give me any credit at all for my predictions. Anyway, I'm running out of time, it looks like. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. You know, buy the book, Crash Proof, or call the office, 800-727-7922. 800-727-7922.